And when you listen to a story like that, and it's coming from someone who looks like Lisa, who you just heard sing, isn't it just the most incredible cognitive dissonance? How does that story come out of that person? It just doesn't seem to make any sense. And the difference is the difference between fear and love. And what I want to do is give you a couple of tools that maybe you can use as you go into your fourth step. Fear and love. There are basically two ways that you can live your life. You can live it in fear, or you can live it in love. But you can't do both at the same time. They're mutually exclusive. Because if you really think about it, fear doesn't really exist as such. If you think about light and darkness, darkness doesn't really exist. It's the absence of light. So light can vanquish darkness, but darkness can't vanquish light. It doesn't work that way. Think about heat and cold. You know, cold doesn't really exist either. It's just the absence of heat. Put some heat in there, you're going to heat it up. Good and evil is the same thing. You know, people are always asking, you know, how could a all-loving God allow evil to exist? Or didn't God create the evil that exists? Well, evil is the absence of good. And good and God are really the roots of the same word anyway. So evil is the absence of God. Is what we're really talking about. Wherever we do not bring God's goodness, that is evil. And it's the same thing with fear and love. Fear is the absence of love. You don't put love into your life, the result is a fearful life. Now, as you all move into your fourth step, the fourth step is made a searching and fearless inventory of ourselves, right? Fearless is not there by any sort of random chance or mistake. Fearless is there on purpose. Because if that inventory that you all make this Saturday is not fearless, it's not going to work. You need to remove everything that would distort the inventory that you're going to take. And fear distorts, because fear is being afraid of losing something. Y'all remember a classic song, Kris Kristofferson nailed this. Me and Bobby McGee. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Now that's coming from kind of a negative point of view, because the next line is nothing and that's all that Bobby left me, right? That darn Bobby. But the converse is true as well. If we are going to be totally free, then we have to be completely unafraid of anything that we could possibly lose. We need to not have a sense of risk, let's put it that way. Because any sense of loss, any sense of fear over risk is going to distort the inventory that we're trying to take. I remember seeing a movie once, and the line that I remember, couldn't even tell you what movie it's from, was that once you're willing to die, no one can make you do anything. Well, that's kind of a bleak statement, but there's a grain of truth in that. Leave it to Jesus to put in a more positive spin on it. He said in Matthew 10:39 and 16:25, whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. You know, he's saying the exact same thing. Somewhere else he said, whoever lays down his life for a friend, there is no greater love than this. All these statements are the same. When Jesus says something like that, no greater love is there than someone lay down his life for his friend, we tend to think of that in terms of his dying. But what we need to think about it is in terms of his living for us. And for us, our willingness to lay down everything we think we are, everything we think we know, everything we think we have, for somebody else, in favor of somebody else, or in favor of our own relationship with God or somebody else, that's laying down our life for a friend. And there's no greater love than that. It's the opposite of fear. What I want to try to do is to impress upon you that fear is the operative thing in all of the negative consequences, negative issues in your life. It all comes down to fear. Now, we have a hard time thinking about that because it doesn't feel like fear. Fear is what we feel when we're walking past the graveyard at night, right? To be afraid, to be terrorized. But fear doesn't feel like that in everyday life. What it feels like is anxiety, stress, depression, anger. Need I go on? Any of the negative emotions that you feel are really rooted in fear. If you want to get to the nub, if you want to get to the core of any negative thing that you're going through, any negative response to the circumstances in your life, there's only one question you need to ask. What am I afraid of? If you can answer that question, you can start to work your way through. What am I afraid of? You know, there's two ways you can usually respond. Well, there's probably more than two. But one of the two interesting ones is envy and jealousy. We tend to get those two things confused and we use them interchangeably, but they're not. Envy is the fear of not getting what someone else has, right? Jealousy is the fear of losing something that you already have. That's two ways that we respond to fear. The fear of loss, fear of losing something. I had someone who just this weekend came to talk to me and his life had become unmanageable. Not because of addictions, but because he was so stressed, he was so frayed, frazzled, he had moved into depression, he was feeling disconnected from God. All of these things were happening in his life. And we're talking about this. Oh, he is divorced. He felt guilty about his kids. He wanted to do right by his kids, so he'd never say no to his kids. So he'd buy things for them, he'd take them everywhere. He never had any time for himself. He went bankrupt because he maxed out all his credit cards, buying things for his kids, his family, doing all these things. Now he's under stress because he's working so many hours at work, trying to do overtime, trying to catch up. He always feels like he can't do enough at work. He always feels like he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, that he's under the gun, that his boss might be thinking something negative about him, all these things. I started talking to him about fear. Now, have you ever had a conversation with somebody and you say something to them and they wait patiently and politely for you to finish and then they immediately start talking about something else? I knew that he didn't get the message. I knew that he didn't hear. So I stopped him and I said, okay, I just talked about fear and you went on, kind of glossed over it. Do you feel like what's going on in your life is not about fear? And he says, well, yeah, I don't really feel that I'm afraid. I'm not fearful of anything. And I said, okay, let's talk for a bit. As he started talking, he started telling me about how his father, in his youth, in his childhood, was unpleasable. There was nothing that he could do to please his father. There was nothing that he could do to be good enough for his dad. As you bring that forward, he learned to cope with that in certain ways. He learned to cope with it by trying to please everybody. He needs to please. He can't stand to have anyone think badly of him. He can't stand to have his kids mad at him. So he keeps saying yes, yes, yes to everything, and he's got to the point where he has no time for anything, and he is completely stressed, and no wonder he's feeling distant from God, because he doesn't have any time to connect. It was all about fear. As he started to see this, and we worked out a punch list of some things for him to do, he called me a couple days ago and said, I feel so much better. It's about the fear. We have to see that fear is at the root of what we're doing here. Fear is at the root of what's driving our lives. You got two sheets there. There's one with lots of words and one's with lots of boxes. Pick up the one with lots of words. Because the other thing that I'm supposed to do is to root this in Scripture. And this is one of my favorite passages in Scripture. Y'all there? What's that? I don't have an extra. I think there's some over there. I'm going to give a second there. Everybody got a sheet? This is 1 John 4:16 to 4:19. For my money, one of the most beautiful passages in Scripture, and it goes like this. We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love. Is there any more shocking statement? God doesn't put on love like a jacket and take it off when he wants to. God doesn't do love. He is love. You have to think about that for a second. It's like having gold earrings that are plated. You can scrape off the gold and there's some other color underneath. But gold earrings, 24 karat gold, are gold all the way down to the periodic table of the elements. God is love. We do love. And when we don't feel like it, we don't. But God is always love. He's always on. Either stand in the output of that love or not. But God is love. And the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this, love is perfected with us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment, because as he is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. Because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. We love because he first loved us. There is so much in there that we can't get into tonight, but I want to just hit on a couple of words, because if we understand what those words really mean, it even brings it more close to home. To know in Greek, gnosko, means to know absolutely, but also to allow, to be aware of, to feel, to perceive, to be resolved, to speak, to be sure, to understand. And even more dramatically, yada in the Hebrew, the word that stands behind the Greek gnosko, is the word for hand, your hand. And the idea is that to know was to be able to handle something, to be able to manipulate it, to be so familiar with this thing that you could feel it in your grasp even when it's not there. That's what knowing means. It's not an intellectual thing. It's a familiarity, an intimacy. And you know, to know in the Old Testament, when Adam knew his wife, he was having intimacy with his wife. That's what knowing means. Not just something that sticks in your head. To believe, pistuo, to have faith, to entrust, to commit, to put trust in. And even aman in the Hebrew is even stronger. And you can read that section below later. We don't have time for that right now. But it means to be steadfast, to continue in. It's the image of Moses having his arms held up so that the battle would continue to go the way of the Hebrews. When his arms went down, they started to lose. When his arms went up, so his friends came up and held his arms. That's the same word that comes from aman. It's called emunah, and it means that steadfastness. That's the idea of what believe means. To love, agape. In the Greek, it's spiritual love. It's love that's beneath the emotions. It's not love that you feel. It's not the love you feel for your dog or your cat or your sister, brother, wife, husband. It's a different kind of love. It's the love that undergirds and the foundation for all that. The original place that agape comes from is from a Greek translation of the Old Testament in the 2nd century BC. They were translating the Hebrew word hesed, which means loving kindness. It also means mercy and compassion, unconditional and absolute love. So we're getting to some place here. To abide, meno, to stay in the same place, in the same relation, or I love this, to stay in expectancy. To continue, to dwell, to endure, to be present, to remain, to stand, to tarry. All of these things. Do you see the common thread that's running through here? Perfect. Teleao. Complete. To accomplish. To consummate. To consecrate. To finish or to fulfill. Not perfect in the sense of perfectionism, but perfect in the sense of completion, maturity, and accomplished. And finally, fear. Phobos, where we get all our phobias from. To be afraid or to hesitate because of fear, but also to be in awe of, to revere, to venerate, to honor, and to be amazed. So you might say, hey, we're supposed to fear the Lord, aren't we? Not in the sense of be afraid of, but in the sense of to honor and revere, to be amazed at. Can God surprise us? You bet. That's fear of the Lord. But in this sense, we're using the other kind of fear. So what I want to do is let's substitute some of those words, and I'm going to read this to you again, and just listen. John 1:4-16, we have come to be intimately familiar with and have put trust in the compassion which God has for us. God is unconditional loving kindness, and the one who is present to mercy is present to God, and God is standing expectantly with him. By this, compassion is accomplished in us, becomes a way of life, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment. Because as he is, so also are we in this world. There is no hesitation, no holding back in loving kindness. But consummated loving kindness casts out all hesitation and sense of risk, because being afraid involves punishment. And the one who is afraid is not accomplished in absolute mercy and compassion. We are merciful because he first showed compassion to us. Does that start to get the sense of what's going on here? We need to be active partners in what happens here. We are the ones who are enduring and steadfast. We are the ones who are bringing our desire to bear and to match up with God's desire. And because he showed that to us first, now we can show it to someone else. But it's an active thing. It's a passionate thing. It's a full body extension kind of thing. There's no holding back, no sense of risk, no, you know, worried about this or that. You just need to let go. So how do we get from fear to love? There's the question, right? Now take out the other sheet. And I know this chart looks very complicated, and if it's too complicated, Y'all know where you can file it, but let's just try and see if this does anything for you. This came out of my tortured mind as I was trying to figure out how can I get this across. The church has traditionally given us two ways that we can go from fear to love, and neither one of them works. And I want to show them to you. See the fear bubble? Trying to get to the perfect love bubble? But there's a break there from the finite to the infinite. Perfect love is infinite. It crosses a threshold that we can't cross with finite tools. We can't even express it in a finite language. We can't hold it in a finite brain. You can't go from fear directly to love. The church has tried to drive people through fear of punishment into the arms of a loving God. But as Lisa said earlier, fear, I think she said, love begets love, but fear only begets more fear. Fear begets fear and more separation and more separation and more separation. Fear will never beget love because fear is actually the absence of love. So how could it ever create love? Only love can create love. So trying to use fear to drive people to love does not work. It breaks down. There's a second way the church has tried to get us to the perfect love of God, and it's through faith. Look at the faith bubble. I just heard a preacher recently say that belief plus proof equals faith. Think about that for a second. Belief plus proof equals faith. And then he went on to try to prove certain things about God. Can you prove the existence of God? Is there any way to prove the existence of God? Once again, you can't prove something that's infinite with finite tools. There is no rational way to prove God's existence. Now here's the beauty of it. You can prove it to yourself, but you can't prove it to anybody else. But you can be absolutely convinced and know that you know that you know that God exists because of the experience of Him that you've had, the knowing that you had, the yada that you had. That will prove it to you, but it's not rational, is it? It's experiential, it's emotional, it's everything beautiful, but it's not proof in the classic sense. So that way doesn't work. What is a way that actually will work? I wanted to take you through the fear way and the love way so that you understand what's happening, hopefully in a more clinical sense. The absence of love brings us into a state of fear. Fear is a state of separation or perceived separation. We feel separated. To the ancients, sin was separation. You know, we say sin leads to separation. To the ancients, the sin was the separation. And anything that we did that led to separation was considered sinful. And anything that led to unity was considered not sinful. But the sin was actually the separation itself. Fear is that feeling of being separate from. The separation creates a sense of risk and loss. Now, that leads directly to the seven deadly sins, and the 12 and 12 talks about those seven deadly sins. But look at them. Pride, greed, lust, envy, gluttony, anger, sloth, which means laziness, non-productiveness. You know, all those things have been the classic examples of the maladies of humanity, but every one of them is rooted in fear. Pride and sloth, pride and laziness, are just like the underachiever and the overachiever that come out of the same family who had an overbearing parent who could never be pleased. One way to deal with it is to overachieve and become prideful. The other way to deal with it is to give up. I can't possibly do that. Both are rooted in fear. You look at greed, lust, and gluttony. All of those are the fear of not getting enough of something. Whether it's all the necessities of life, food, sex, money, whatever that happens to be, all the material possessions, their fear of losing that. Envy we talked about, and her sister jealousy, fear of not getting something, fear of losing what you have. And then anger is the result of all the frustration of simply not getting whatever it is that you're after in life. And the result is anger. All of those negative emotions, all of those cardinal sins, if you want to call them that, are going to lead to what we feel, the stress, the depression, the anxiety in life. If those are not dealt with, those are your indicators. Those are your motivators. That's the vibration on the divining rod that tells you something's wrong in your life. If you don't deal with those at that point, they harden into bitterness and resentment. And that's the next phase. If you go far enough in that route, then you're going to hit the breakdown place. You're going to hit bottom. Your life is going to become completely unmanageable, and you're not going to be able to sustain it anymore. And you are in that place of separation. Jesus called it Gehenna, that place of torment or torture. At the same time, that little side chain there, that's where your addictions come from. Dealing with those areas of frustration, those areas of perceived loss, to mask the feelings that you're having, you start to use something. And it may not be a substance. You know, it may be relationships, it may be overworking, it may be overeating, it could be something that's socially acceptable, but it's still being used as a mask. You are not moving any further into health because you're shelved off at that point. Now, the way of love is completely different, isn't it? Perfect love gives you confidence and trust, which gives you good relationships, which brings you into a state of unity, and God, Jesus, called that the kingdom of God. Now, how do we get from one to the other? The beauty of the breakdown is because once again, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. When you get finally to hit bottom, you're at the place where you lose your sense of fear, you lose your sense of risk because you've got nothing left to lose. You've lost everything already. So maybe it's okay at this point to try something different. Maybe it's okay at this point to risk because you don't even feel a sense of risk anymore. And that will take you in to a place where you can possibly have faith in something you've never had faith in before. And here we need to make a distinction. Faith to us, once again, if it's not belief plus proof equals faith, then at least it's faith in the sense of, again, in our heads, in our minds, we mentally agree to believe something. This is the creed I believe in, all right? This is the doctrine I believe in. This is the church I believe in. This is the country that I believe in. These are the things that I have faith in. To the ancients, it was not so. To the ancients, take a look. Belief was only the beginning, because belief plus action equals trust. And anytime you see the word faith in the Bible, whether it's in the Greek or whether it's in the Aramaic or whether it's in the Hebrew, faith is never apart from trust. The two always go together. In the sense that there had to be some action associated with the faith. What you believe is what you do. What you do is what you believe. The only way, as James 1 says, that you can know if you have any faith is if it's already changing your life. If it's causing you to make different choices, if it's causing you to live in a different way, what you are doing is telling not only you, but the entire world what you believe. Doesn't matter what you say you believe. Doesn't matter what you think you believe. What you're doing is what you have faith in. And so, B-A-T, try to remember that one. Belief plus action equals trust. We're going to bat, bat, B-A-T. Think about that. That is the actual biblical way of looking at faith. It's what we're doing. If we got into this cycle where suddenly there's nothing left to lose anymore, and now we're willing to try something different, that trying is going to give us experience of God. The experience of God is going to be proving him to be trustworthy. Do you know that you cannot manufacture trust? You can't will yourself to trust anything, can you? If someone breaks your trust, how hard is it to get it back? The only way you get it back is to live with that person on an ongoing basis and let them reprove themselves to be trustworthy. And then slowly you'll begin to trust them, but it's experience-based. You need the experience, you need the yada of God to know that he's trustworthy. That will give you the faith. And then, with no proof whatsoever, you can bridge that gap from the finite to the infinite, and you start to experience what perfect love, what loving kindness is all about. And that throws you down a whole new way of life. Now, if you think that that's all you need to do and it's gone, you heard the last few paragraphs that Lisa gave us. It doesn't work that way. Are you, now that you've committed yourself and you've recommitted yourself and you have faith, actual experience in a loving God, is that going to mean that you're never going to be stressed, depressed, or anxious again? Absolutely not. This is a human condition. This is the frailty we have. But look what happens. Now, with these tools, when you get down to stress, anxiety, and depression, those are the motivators. Every negative feeling, every negative emotion you have is a motivator. If someone is happy and content, they don't want to move from that spot, do they? It's the negative things that make us want to move. It's a negative thing like putting your hand on a hot stove that tells you, I need to move, something is wrong. This is what gets you to move. We didn't heed those before, did we? Because we still had too much fear. We had still too much risk associated. So we let them stay. They didn't move us. We had to get all the way down to hit bottom before we were ready to move. Now, We can say, when I feel stressed or depressed, I know what's wrong. Just as Lisa said, I know this feeling. I know what this means. It means I have strayed from my connection with the loving kindness of God, and I need to just reconnect. And I can go directly from there back to faith and back to perfect love. This is the cycle that we will experience for the rest of our lives. But as we go through this repeatedly, it's like a sine wave. You know what a sine wave is? What happens is the troughs and they start to compress. So your highs are not as, your highs are still high, but your lows are not as low. And then they start to move out. So these cycles are fewer and further between. And you can stay in those moments with God, those kingdom moments, if you will, for longer and longer periods of time. You string them together until your life is characterized by kingdom. And that's the goal. You want to be characterized. That means more often than not, I am present to, I am standing with, and I am connected to my God, and I'm connected to the love of God. And then in the 11th and 12th steps, you can give it back. I mean, that's the whole goal here. I want to leave you with one story that I think illustrates it perfectly for me anyway. Mother Teresa, one of my heroes, probably stood about this tall. Amazing woman. John Kavanaugh was a famous ethicist and writer in the United States, and he had hit bottom. He got all the way to the bottom. And he was done. He didn't know what to do. Everything in his life just seemed like dust. And so he took a pilgrimage, and he went to Calcutta, and he went to talk to Mother Teresa. That seemed like something that he needed to do to try to break out of where he was at. And he got to speak with her, and they got together, and she looked at him. She says, well, what can I do for you? And he said, oh, just pray for me. She said, well, what shall I pray for? He said, pray that I have clarity. And she looked at him, and she said, no, I won't do that. And of course, he was shocked. And he says, why not? He says, because clarity is the last thing that you are holding on to and need to let go of. And then he said, but you always seem to have such clarity. And she just laughed. And she says, I don't have clarity. I have trust. I will pray that you have trust. Trust looks like clarity from the outside, but from the inside, it's the unknowing. We need to understand that our life will never have all of the elements that we want it to have. We will never have all of the information that we need to make a decision and a choice that we need to make in this moment. But we can always lean on the trust, and in the trust, the unknowing becomes friendly again. I will pray that you all have trust. Amen.